Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Ginny Weber about her novel, Bed Trick. Earlier this year, I talked with Jessica Barksdale Inclán about her dual-time Shakespeare novel. Here we are back in Elizabethan theater, but from a very different perspective. The time period is about the same, but the narrator is one Alexander Cook, one of Shakespeare's company, then known as the Lord Chamberlain's Men. We'll find out more about him as the interview progresses, but the tale opens on a disturbing scene. Never till tonight, never till now, did I go through a tempest dropping fire. Either there is a civil strife in heaven, or else the world, too saucy with the gods, incenses them to send destruction. Casca, Julius Caesar. Chapter 1, March, 1599. The crowd surged close around me, the drizzling rain adding to the stench of unwashed clothes and sweaty bodies. My brother and fellow players were nowhere to be seen in the melee, and my ears rang. Defeat the rebel Tyrone! Death to the Irish! Essex is our man! On to victory! Long live the Queen, drowned out by death, death, death. Nothing I wanted more than to escape the ferociousness that underlay this show of patriotism. But it was all I could do to hold my own. We'd come to see the Earl of Essex and his men on their nobly caparisoned horses, parading toward their ships bound for Ireland. Instead, the mob pushed and shoved to get a closer view, shouting and cheering. I stumbled against them, pushing my way out, along with a father clutching the legs of the small boy on his shoulders. And now, please join me in welcoming Ginny Weber. Hi, Ginny. Thank you for agreeing to talk with me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Carolyn.
Please start by telling us a bit about your background. You've written plays and short stories, as well as this novel in a couple of different forms. How did you get into writing fiction?
Well, I've always wanted to write. Ever since I was a child, I started writing things. And in junior high, I wrote something and various times. But I knew that I had a family to support, you know, contribute to the family, practical considerations. So I went into college teaching and that was my career. But I was always writing something, at least poetry and journals, if nothing else. And when I had more time, when my children were grown, more independent, I was able to sit down to novels. And that's what I've most enjoyed. I like the undertaking something long. So the Shakespeare novels were my favorite, though I have written an unpublished one set in Bronze Age Greece. But basically, I'm interested in Shakespeare's era, having taught Shakespeare, having performed myself in plays, having written in three of his plays in, you know, amateur theater in Santa Barbara, where I live, and also having written plays, three of which spring off something in Shakespeare.
What's the genesis of this particular story?
Well, I was interested in how Shakespeare, well, for one thing, creates really strong female characters, but for another, there's a lot of gender play, whether it's exchanging of roles, which he did quite early in Two Gentlemen of Verona, but later, significantly with significantly with As You Like It. And that play interested me. My students loved it. It's one that I performed in as Corinne the Shepherd, as a woman, who is, of course, a man. And I also directed a faculty production of that play once for a sabbatical project, which everyone loved being in. But what's so intriguing is that Rosalind, the protagonist, spends most of the play disguised as Ganymede, a male. And she's a shepherd, supposedly, because she had to flee the court. So I thought, well, early on, way before I wrote Bed Trick, I thought, well, what if a girl was disguised as a boy, went to London or landed somehow in London, is in London, and she was able to perform on stage because only boys could perform on stage, but she plays female roles, and then some of those female roles are disguised as guys. So I thought that layering of those various, you know, of girl playing a boy, playing a girl playing a boy, was just hugely entertaining, and you know, that readers would like that idea too. And it would make all sorts of complications and obstacles. So yes, this is the third novel I've written about actually the same character, but each one is a separate story and Bed Trick stands alone.
Before we get into the plot, I'd like to ask you about the title. What is a bed trick and why is it the right title for this novel?
Well, I do get asked that a lot. And in fact, I mentioned to people for my book signing, I'm going to explain the title. But two of Shakespeare's comedies rest on a plot called a bed trick plot. And basically what that is that a man rejects the woman that he's promised to and lusts after another. He ends up sleeping with the woman he rejected, thinking she's the one he lusts after. So the bed trick is that he doesn't know who he's sleeping with and that seals the marriage. And the overall definition of a bed trick is any lie about sex. So in fact, everyone who sleeps with everyone else in my novel knows who that person is. But the lie is to the world about my protagonist and her spouse or his spouse, depending which you think.
Your hero is Alexander Cook, known to his friends as Sander. And he has a rather unusual background for a Shakespearean actor, which you've hinted at just now. But what can you tell us about him?
Sander Cook's actually a historical actor. When I first started this book, I had the actor name something else. I made up name and was a girl. So I left the same female name, which was Kate Collins. So Sander Cook was born as Kate Collins in the village of Saffron Wold, and this is my invention, northeast of London, charming little village today. And she she's a motherless child. Her mother died giving birth to her brother 2 years younger. So she grows up. The father, who drinks too much, relies on her to run the house, but she's a total tomboy and a wild child, really. And he decides he should get her tamed by marrying her to this dullard of a sheep farmer. So she has once before tried out wearing her brother's clothes, and she loves the freedom. So she escapes the village. This is before my story begins, but it's the backstory is told in Bed Trick. She escapes the village and runs off and was planning to go to sea. She heard about girls who go off and become pirates. And on the way, she runs into an acting troupe. And when they visited Saffron Walden, she befriended an actor in it. And she said, oh, I want to be an actor. That would be so fun. I've been an actor all my life. And he goes, no, girls can't do that. So there she is. There's the troupe. And she joins up with them. And eventually, through various complications, she gets to London. Not an easy thing to do. It's a traveling, you know, practically vagabonds. But anyway, she gets to London and becomes an actor. So Alexander Cook is a historic actor who was not born female. But in my version, that's the truth. And very few people can know that secret because it's a quite terrible thing to pass as a woman as far as the law is concerned and the church.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. And it's about to get more terrible for Sander if indeed he were found out. It was fascinating to me when I discovered this because it's really a matter of hierarchy. That is, men are considered superior to women. So for a woman to pretend to be a man or to dress as a man was a challenge to the male authority ladder. And so Sander is, in effect, taking his life in his hands, just walking around London in men's clothes.
Yes, that's a really good point. It is a matter of the power structure. Women were defined to be chaste, obedient, dependent, silent. That's important. There was a pub called the Silent Woman, and the image of it is a woman with headless woman holding her head, the pub sign. So, yeah, a woman was supposed to be silent. So Shakespeare certainly breaks that. And it was beginning to break down a little bit because after the period of this novel takes place between 1599 and 1603. So Sander's established in London by the time it opens. Queen Elizabeth dies at the end. And early in the next century, they started publishing booklets against men dressing like women or women dressing like men. And they didn't mean in disguise totally, but just with those elements. And it was considered witchcraft. You could be burned as a witch, you could be whipped, you could be pilloried, you know, that horrible thing where they stick your head and your and your arms into a thing in front of the city square. But you would certainly get punished for it by the law and by the church. That was what was going on publicly. Privately, well, that's another matter, perhaps.
Oh, I'm sure, privately. And in fact, in your novel, there are people who know who turn a blind eye and don't report Sander.
Yes.
Right.
Right. Sander is known. And then there's also this notorious woman, which some of your listeners may have heard of because every so often she comes to the surface. And her name was Moll Frith, and she was also known as Moll Cutpurse. She's a totally historic person, although her birth date isn't known. It's suspected. So I made her a closer contemporary. So they're friends. She goes about blatantly in men's clothing. She smokes a pipe. Drawings were made of her. A play was written about her called The Roaring Girl. And at one point she tells Sander she has friends in high places. And how could she get away with it is a good question. But somehow it carries a day. And she also is on the wrong side of the law in other ways. That's being an outlaw in itself. But she's also on the wrong side of the law. She gets called into court a few times, mostly gets free of the punishment once she was supposed to be whipped and she went drunk. I mean, she's just a character. So, of course, she had to be in my book.
Of course she did. And she's a real addition. And we'll get back to some of her contributions in a moment. How does Sander end up in what is initially a marriage of convenience with Frances Field?
Right. That's the theme of the book. It's the story. The previous two books have other stories that they're about. You know, theater and politics run through all of them, and they're chronological, but they aren't a series per se. So what the story here is really about her marriage, and that's what the bed trick is, that she marries a woman. And I'm going to use the gender pronoun she. Now, I know if she were truly transgender, I would call her he, but she is a she through this play, so I'll go ahead and say she, because she's not truly transgender. The typical reason for a marriage of necessity would be pregnancy. And Frances is pregnant by Sander's brother. Sander's brother, 2 years younger when the mother died giving him birth, he has followed her to London. And in fact, there was a historic John Cook as well as a historic Alexander Cook. And John Cook, little known is about him, except that he wrote a play called The City Gallant, and it had another name too. But that's the main play, at least one in the mode of Ben Jonson. And it was in 1611. So anyway, he's impregnated Frances. And Frances owns her own seamstress shop on London Bridge. She's a businesswoman. She's young, but she's a businesswoman. And she's pregnant, and Johnny does not do the proper thing. He just won't marry her. He has other ideas in his life, other plans, and he won't marry her. He says, well, you can marry her, everyone thinks you're a guy. You've got the same last name. I think it's a great idea. And, of course, she really balks, and Frances really balks, because she was raised in the old faith, in other words, Roman Catholicism. And she had to give it up because Queen Elizabeth has established the Anglican Church. But still, you know, she's a religious, at heart, a religious woman. And this is a terrible idea. However, she would lose her business if she gave birth to a bastard. You could get away with it in the country. Someone else in your family would raise the child. But in London, nope, she can't get away with it. So Sander finally takes mercy on her. And I am giving away a little of the plot because it doesn't happen immediately. But I won't give any more of the plot that's significant. But the whole point is that she does marry her. So there is a marriage of two women. And it's a marriage of convenience. Neither is gay. Neither ever thought of a female partner. Sander, in fact, once loved a man. But, of course, she couldn't be with him. That would give up her, she would have to give up her career. The man happened to be John Donne, the poet, when he was really young, because he's so handsome. If you look at his portrait, that, wow, that's who she would fall in love with. And he with her. But he's too, you know, he's too young. He's still a law student. She's a girl that has to stay boy. So, you know, but she can marry Francis. And so she does.
She does, indeed. Now, if it's a problem for a woman to don men's clothes, it's a much bigger problem in Elizabethan England for a woman, for two women to marry, because that's really undercutting the domestic hierarchy. And it's Moll Frith who helps them do this. How does she do it? Because I think we can talk about the marriage, since that's mentioned even on the back cover of the book.
Yes, I think we can. Yes, well, I was going to have it be a clandestine marriage. There was such a thing. In fact, a friend of mine, a British scholar, no longer living, but he wrote a whole book called Clandestine Marriages. You could go to the country. You could get a sketchily ordained priest. You could get a couple of, you could even marry without any priest and have a couple witnesses and go sign the registry book after. There are all kinds of things you could get away with in the country if there was no priest in your village, if you were pregnant, etc. But, as far as being in London, no. So my British friend said, you know, she's got to be married by a real priest. So Moll was the only one who knows a priest is reputable enough to be maintain his being ordained, but also not be have too close an eye to the couple or the proprieties of it. Maybe, you know, just you can get away with a little more. So she find they go to this priest in the depths of Bankside, south side of the Thames, where the brothels and the bear baiting, and in fact, some of the theaters, not all, but they, some of the theaters were. They were all in the suburbs, some north, some south. So Moll takes, arranges this drunken priest, who's a perfectly nice guy, he's just drunk, to marry them, and Francis agrees to it, and they get officially married and sign the registry. So that's the only way they can do it, is legally, but not quite within propriety.
What is Johnny's role in all this, besides the obvious that he has fathered Francis's child? Why does he dodge his responsibilities?
Yes, that's a big question. I actually thought about that for a long time, because how would that happen? And so he has aspirations for something else. He just does not want to be married. And even though he would become in control by the laws of the day in England of Francis' shop, he has no interest in that. And, you know, it was fun to be with her, but he does not want a life with her because he is playing court. Now, this is not in a necessarily sexual way to Lady Elizabeth Sidney. And she has a, historically, she's a real historic person, and she had a coterie around her that included the playwright Ben Jonson and a younger playwright, Frances Beaumont. She's known for that. She was married to the Earl of Rutland when she was very young, and he was known to be impotent, but that's beside the point. Johnny's not necessarily filling in her husband's duty or anything like that. But it was a thing for aristocratic women to, maybe her husband had syphilis, actually. People don't know for sure, but he definitely didn't, wasn't able to father children. In any case, she entertained herself as her aunt, Mary Sidney, who's also a character in the book, had done, with surrounding herself with poets, and she wrote poetry herself. And so he wants to be in her coterie. He wants to, he thinks her patronage and possibly living at her house as a courtier is a role that he could do, because aristocratic women did have men like that. They weren't necessarily sexual. Queen Elizabeth loved it that her courtiers wrote her all kinds of flattering poetry. Anne Boleyn got in trouble, obviously. Henry VIII accused her based on that. But it was a a tradition since the troubadour. So Johnny fancies himself a troubadour to Lady Elizabeth Sidney, rightly or wrongly, and he just doesn't want to marry a seamstress, even if she owns her own shop. So that's why he won't marry her.
Yeah, that is the other side of Elizabethan England, which is worth mentioning. It's true that ordinary women, and that includes even women who own their own shops, because they, if they married, they didn't own their property. They didn't even own their children. It all went to the man. But there were these aristocratic women who were very well educated and who were patrons of the arts. And as you pointed out, especially with the Sydney women and Elizabeth the First herself, they wrote poetry and they wrote, they were quite involved in the artistic scene.
Absolutely. That was an amazing family, the Sidneys, just an amazing family. So those women were properly educated. Now, of course, they couldn't, even in Virginia Woolf's day, they couldn't get a college degree or even go. Virginia Woolf had tutors. That's, the late 19th, early 20th century. But they were tutored. Their families had big libraries. They had, if they were aristocratic, they had very educated people, men mostly, of course, coming to their house, and they were allowed to listen into the conversations. So that definitely was an important part of it. Normal women did not get an education, did not write. There were so many things they were prohibited from, but in the Elizabethan age, possibly from having a queen in charge, women were breaking out of that. And the first women writers, there were women who wrote random poetry, but the first ones actually wrote sort of religious tracts. They found that their husbands would be a pastor, and they learned to read and write. Their literacy rate, I'll add real quickly, is that the literacy rate in England was way higher than on the continent. A friend of mine wrote a book called Reading and Writing in Early Modern England, if I got the title wrong, the author's Nigel Wheel, but anyway, he was one of my advisors, in fact, but on historic details. But literacy, as far as reading, was pretty widespread for women of all classes, surprisingly. Writing, a little less so. Some people claim Anne Hathaway, Shakespeare's wife, couldn't write because she put an X for her name, but whether that's true or not, Maggie Farrell would probably disagree. But anyway, there was a lot of change in the air about women's position, but the law wasn't changing.
Right. That's a good point. Let's move to William Shakespeare, because he and his plays at the Globe Theatre form a large part of the novel that is not directly connected to the marriage, because that is Sandra's life. That's how he or she supports herself. How would you describe your Will Shakespeare as seen through Sandra's eyes?
Okay, well, you get lots of choices with Shakespeare. You can make him into whatever you want, but I tried to base his personality on the aspects of his biographies that I liked. And I also liked John Aubrey and his brief lives. He was writing in the 17th century, and he was writing short biographies of a lot of people, and he tried to talk, if they were dead, to people who knew them. And he got to Stratford not long after Susanna Hall, Shakespeare's daughter, died. And so he only could get hearsay. All of the family had died, all of his siblings, his children. There was no one, no survivors by the time John Aubrey got to Stratford or started interviewing. So he got all these reports, secondhand reports, that Shakespeare was a modest person and quiet, and he would go to parties, but he'd leave early and he'd just observe what was going on. And he'd engage. He liked intellectual conversation and so on, but he was quiet, and he would, I remember reading this about James Baldwin. He loved parties, and then he would go home and write afterwards. So I kind of added that to my characterization of Shakespeare, that, and also he didn't make a very prepossessing appearance. He wasn't wearing plumes in his hat like John Donne and Mulfrith, and he wasn't wearing shoes with rosettes like Henry Risley. He was, I dress him in brown. When he gets more money, he wears nicer quality brown, but he mostly dresses in brown and just doesn't stand out. And it is known by what little information we have, as you know it's very scanty about real information. Biographies tend to say he may have, he might have, you know, but anyway. But he is known to have played fairly small roles in his plays, like the faithful old retainer Adam in As You Like It. Hamlet's ghost father is typically often maybe a king who doesn't show up much, or Aegeus in Midsummer Night's Dream who shows up at the beginning and end. Small roles. And he played in Ben Jonson's plays, too, because we have some casts of characters that were kept at in the day by Philip Henslowe. So yeah, he was an actor, at least for a while. But I make him a modest person, and he and Sander are friends. And he's actually encouraging about her relationship. You know, he runs into them after their marriage, and so he goes along to the wedding breakfast. So he's in on the wedding, the marriage between Sander and Frances. But there's one little wrinkle, and that is that he does base his plays, the actors in his plays are based on the company to a large extent, and to something they can do, not their personalities, but something within their skill level. And his stories use all kinds of things obliquely. And these bed trick plays are way too close, in Sander's opinion, to her marriage with Frances. It kind of turns out that way. Because when they're seen together, it's just a little bit of a problem for her to see a callow person like Bertram in All's Well That Ends Well, who behaves so much like Johnny. And she just doesn't like any similarity at all to her situation. So she has a little bit of anxiety. But the other thing is that another point that I do want to make about Shakespeare and being influenced by his characters, if you have a really good actor who can play really good female parts, you can write really good female parts. And so Edmund Malone was an 18th century critic, and he speculated that this character, this actor called Alexander Cook, originated Shakespeare's principal female roles. So that's the part I really want to emphasize in the story, is the way, not that they work together, there's no way that I'm saying Sander Cook wrote anything, but their conversations and their relationship does contribute, or the ability that she has, let's say, on stage to play Macbeth doesn't happen in this, hasn't yet happened, and Cleopatra, those come up in the 17th century. Sander can do it. That's the point. Anything he wants to write, she can play way beyond what you'd expect of a boy. And also make one other point. We assume that these female roles were played by boys. That's what's always said. But I did find documentation that young men up to, say, 21, if a young man is slender and keeps the bloom of youth, he can continue playing female roles. I just cannot picture a 14-year-old boy, let alone younger, playing Lady Macbeth or Cleopatra. So,
even a 21-year-old, it's hard to imagine of, you know, either gender, frankly.
Exactly. So that gave me, of course, there's also novelistic license, which I use a few times. I have another way I use novelistic license, which may or may not spoil the plot, so I'm not sure if I'll mention it. Several other ways, actually. But one would be that Sander can continue playing female roles. Her brother quits way before she does. You know, he's not going to do that anymore. He's got a beard and broad shoulders, but she smudges her cheeks, and so does Moll Frith also. And any boy actor would do that. And she kind of gets away with it. I also figured out a way she could do costume changes, because they wore layers, you know, so she'd have a shift on underneath. So it didn't, those things were no longer a problem. She's more or less mastered how to behave as a male, even though she isn't. And there's also the slight pragmatic thing, if one of her fellow actors suspects, well, they're all working together. So at this point, she might be able to get away with it, even if they figured out she was female. But most of the major actors do never, with this company, never do figure it out. They just take her at face value.
There's a lot going on in England itself at this time because we're approaching the end of Queen Elizabeth's life and she hasn't named a successor, and that creates all kinds of tensions within the society, which I think we won't go into because most of them are played out later in the book. But at its heart, this is a story about two people who are trying to make a life together, and it's not always easy for them, just as it's not easy for any married couple. What are some of the personal challenges that they face?
Right. They're definitely affected by what goes on in the outside world, but they're affected by really what is the nature of their relationship? What can they even be together? I thought that was a very interesting question that two women who never imagined having a female partner, who probably both to one extent or another assumed not ever to marry. Certainly Sander would never marry. And I don't think that Frances has really worked it out, but she does have a good independent life and income, so she wouldn't have to, and she's leery of, you know, like I said, a man could take over her business or tell her what to do or close it down or anything. So here they are trying to work out a relationship, and, you know, there's a child involved, complications around that, which I won't go into, but I thought that was really the through line of the story, and that's what inspired me to write this particular story and to call it Bed Trick. So it is backed up by what's going on politically and theatrically, and that gives a lot more, you know, interest and texture. But the real story is them, and they go through a lot of different stages of that relationship, and I thought that's what will keep the reader's interest. Like, how is this going to work out? Because, you know, how would it work out is really, it's a good question. And so that's really the focus. And where will it all end? Can there be a happy ending? Is that such a thing that can even happen? And so much goes on that could mitigate against that.
What would you like people to take away from Bed Trick?
Well, you know, it's very applicable to the sexual mores and gender roles of the moment. There was no such, the word gender existed, but it wasn't used about gender fluidity. Would not have been a word or concept they had. They would just say you were the sex, you were male sex or the female sex. But we call it gender fluidity. And that's going on right now in a very interesting way. There are a lot of changes are going on in the world. And that's why we're having trouble with the pronoun here, because they're fully on trans people. But so I just thought it would be interesting to see that what were the sexual mores in those days and how do they relate to today? So that was one part that just plays around with same-sex marriage and women trying to take on a male role. Male men, to some degree, they were dressing in effeminate ways, certainly, at least certain classes of men. And then there's also the issue of the uncertainty, which you referred to. And I think it's helpful to realize that times we look back on and think were great, like the Elizabethan era, was such a blooming of theater and the New World exploration, and it was just this exciting, blooming time. And yet people living in that time felt terrible anxiety and insecurity. And towards the end of Queen Elizabeth's life, was still no successor named, and bunches of numerous, you know, royal-blooded people that could, and even mounting rebellions against her. People living at the time were starting to pack up and thinking they better leave London, and there's plague on the horizon. It was terrible. And yet, we look back at it warmly because of the long-term view. So I just thought that would be also relate to people today who, you know, we can get so caught up in the horrible things you read in the news, and maybe want to not read the news at all. And yet in the long run, maybe things will be looked back on in a different light in, you know, our own lives. And in any case, it does give us a more complicated view of the history of Queen Elizabeth's era, that it wasn't necessarily seen as wonderful by everyone especially towards the end of it, even earlier, I mean, all through her reign. So there's never a time that's so illustrious that we really want to go back to it, or that is really so much preferable to our own. Something like that. I don't mean to be moralistic. I'm not being. I'm just saying it gives a different perspective.
It does indeed. And this book has just come out. Are you already working on something new?
I am. It relates to the Sidney family, not Lady Elizabeth so much. She's a character. Unfortunately, none of her poems survived, and I wrote one in her voice, and I can't find it. But anyway, I do have something that I'm carrying on into the next century, and Sander will still be a character in Shakespeare's plays because we haven't gotten to some of his important plays yet that I would really want to touch on. But I do have another story, yes, and it's got some romance, it's got some intrigue and scandal and poetry and a bit of theater and King James rule, which was very different from Elizabeth. It's not a, you know, monarchical history, but that's the background. So yeah, I've got a project I've written loads of scenes, but I've got to structure them into something a little more whole and then fill in the other kind of hole. So yeah, I do have a new project coming. Thank you.
Well, I look forward to seeing it because I really enjoyed Bedtrick. Thank you so much for spending your time with us today, Jenny.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Hope I didn't talk too fast. Thanks so much.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I am C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I've been talking with Jenny Weber about Bedtrick. Find out more about her at www.jennyweber.com. Like us on Facebook, search for NB Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at NewBooksHistFic. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can find out more about me and my books at www.cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about historical fiction on the New Books Network.